Thank you for joining us for another podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California.
Good evening and welcome to tonight's program, Leftover in China, The Women Shaping the World's Next Superpower, with author Roseanne Lake. Roseanne Lake has reported from 14 continents over her journalism career. She speaks five languages, and her work has appeared in a wide range of media outlets, including the BBC, the South China Morning Post, Foreign Policy, the Wall Street Journal, and the Atlantic. She is currently The Economist's Cuba correspondent. She was previously based in Beijing as a television reporter and journalist. It was here that she became interested in the social and economic power of China's women. Her research was adapted into a play, which premiered in Beijing and was also performed in Shanghai. Her play and research were also the subject of a TED Talk. Her new book, Leftover in China, The Women Shaping the World's Next Superpower, discusses the trailblazing female urban elite, more commonly referred to as leftover women, and I'm sure she will tell us why. Would you please join me in welcoming Roseanne Lake?
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you, everyone, for coming. It's wonderful to be here. I really appreciate that you've come indoors from this wonderful weather to come hear me talk about unmarried women. I've also never worn a headset like this, so if I burst into song, just make me stop. So Leftover in China was, the book was essentially one big accident. Those of you who knew me in Beijing knew that I did not set out to China to write a book. I actually only intended to stay for about 3 months. I had recently graduated from NYU. I had a degree in journalism, and I thought, China's just come out on the world stage. The Olympics have just happened. Everyone's writing about China and everyone's interested in China. It's probably a much better place to attempt to be a journalist than New York, where I'd rather unglamorously be, you know, serving coffee, right? So I head off to China thinking it would be great to pick up some Mandarin as well. I was curious about the language. I grew up speaking Romance languages at home and thought, you know, Chinese would be a real linguistic challenge. So I got to China and I made the one mistake of buying, shortly after I got there, a diandongche, an electric scooter, right? A hot orange electric scooter, which I quickly named Fanta, just like the soft drink. And Jenny's nodding because she's been on Fanta with me. She's very brave to get on the back, by the way. So I bought this scooter, and I'd ride around the bike lanes of Beijing, which at the time, as it is now, is this absolutely dizzying place. And I was fascinated by the fact that you could be cruising in a bike lane, and to my right, there would be buildings going up at superhuman rates, right? Skyscrapers. And that to my left, there would be giant flatbed trucks driven by peasants from the countryside, piled high with baicai, you know, white cabbage that they would be selling. This sort of contrast was something that didn't seem like you would get in many other places in the world. And I was very intrigued by it. And also, riding Fanta around Beijing was a bit like outdoor theater. I didn't know any Chinese at the time. And so everything was interesting to me automatically. And you know, Chinese people in Beijing, especially in Hutongs, do some very interesting things. They walk around with fighter crickets in small cages, birds in cages. They hang laundry in all sorts of different places. They improvise a lot of things. So, you know, I would kind of ride around on Fanta and just park whenever I saw something curious and just sort of take it in. And it was also a really good way for me to learn Chinese because Beijing is a city with about 17 million people, a lot of cars and a lot of bikes, and that leads to a lot of road rage, right? So when people scream in Chinese, expletives happen to be some of the first things that I picked up. In fact, shortly after getting Fanta, I was on my way to Chinese class one day, and I said to my teacher, someone just called me a bendan. What is that? And she, you know, she didn't speak English, but we worked it out. They called me a dumb egg, right? This is an insult in China when you're not behaving on the road. So Fanta really was like outdoor theater, and I would stop and I would park when I would see interesting things. And one of the first sort of vivid memories that I have on Fanta was at the intersection of the Second Ring Road at Dongzhimen Y. I don't know how many of you know Beijing well, but it's this tentacular intersection that looks like it's sort of been designed by like a truant pizza slicer that just went in every direction, right? It's a very treacherous intersection. And as I was approaching it, there was a woman on the side of the street with a stiletto in her hand. And the first thing that struck me about the stiletto was that it was very sparkly. I was like, wow, this is, you know, huge bling factor. Very impressed by that. But she was hammering it into the forehead of a man. And she was doing it with such vigor that I was worried that the man would soon have a stoma between his forehead, right, between his eyes. And I thought, wow, you know, something just seems afoul with the state of romantic relationships in China. I don't understand this place. I'm still in my salad days of making sense of it. But something is just off about this place. So shortly after, I got a job at a television station. I had a scooter to support, so I needed a job. I was working with a rather remarkable population of young women. All of them were in their early 20s. Many of them were only daughters. Most all of them were the first women in their families to have gone to college. They were from other cities, so they were supporting themselves in Beijing. And I was quite surprised by this. I sort of expected, you know, to be working with more men, perhaps. But no, most of the men that we worked with were the cameramen. They were monolingual, and they were just taking orders from the women who were calling the shots. They were the producers, the editors, and this was an international news network. We were broadcasting news about China in New York. And so we became friends, and over the course of, you know, sleeper trains to Inner Mongolia and delayed flights, we were traveling over China, we got to know one another. But it wasn't until after my first Chunjia, after my first Chinese New Year, that things really started to make sense. And actually, that first Chinese New Year, I went on holiday with Jenny. We went to Yunnan, and we were motorbiking around magnificent pineapple fields and all sorts of places. I had a great time, and I assumed most of my colleagues did as well. And I got back to the office and noticed, was rather puzzled to see that my colleagues were in a very different mood. They weren't as chipper and as animated as they usually were. And because no one was really saying anything to me, I went to see one of the superiors on staff, and she said, oh, they're just upset because they're not married, in a very matter-of-fact way. And I was very puzzled by this, but she seemed to be giving no indication of wanting to elaborate. And so I kind of just left. And eventually, one of the news producers, Shan Shan, opened up to me. And she explained that she had just come home from her laojia, from her hometown, with a fresh lacquering of marriage pressure. That her parents, her grandparents, her neighbors, her former classmates, even taxi drivers. Beijing taxi drivers or taxi drivers in China can be very meddlesome. You know, if they'll ask you, "Ni jiehun le ma? Are you married?" And if you're not, they're like, "Oh, stop the car. Let's find this woman a wife. We got a husband. We've got to do this now," right? They get involved. And so essentially everyone in her hometown had been treating her like a burning building for the very simple fact that she hadn't come home. Oh, I see heads nodding. for the very simple fact that she hadn't come home with news of a boyfriend or a potential spouse and, you know, a person who she could make a child with, right? So her parents could complete their life's goal and be able to balsunza, to have a grandchild. And I thought, well, this is a bit outrageous. I mean, all of what these women have accomplished, these first generations of women to have gone to college, to support themselves in a big city, to be multilingual, to be well-educated, all of this is eclipsed by the very simple fact that they're not married by 24. And because the oldest one in the bunch was 27, and they were all known as shengnyu, or leftover women. And I was a bit dismayed that they were called this way. And my first reaction was, well, let me come in with a bit of New York City moxie and see if I can, like, change the mood in the office. Like, turn this around. It didn't work. But another part of me was puzzled. The commonly cited statistic from the Chinese Academy of Social Sciences was already out. By 2020, there will be 30 million more men of marriage age than women in China. So if part of me thought, you know, I was a bit outraged by this term that they were given. But another part of me thought, there's so many men. Why could it be so difficult? And if your parents really give you such a hard time over the holidays, can't you just kind of bring a man home temporarily, tick that box, and then part ways after? I mean, you know, what's going on here? And when I asked them about the man shortage, I kind of got blank stares. No one really had answers or could explain why this was so. So I did a little bit of digging because I wanted to find these men, 30 million surplus men, right? If I can bring them into the office, surely we can all be happy again. Where are they? So I turned to demography and started to look at where the where these surplus men could be in China. And it became quickly apparent that the gender imbalance, which resulted, of course, from the one-child policy, which began in 1979, and given China's preference for boys, led to an imbalance that of surplus men. That beginning in 1979, what we start to see is that in major cities like Beijing, Shanghai, Tianjin, the gender imbalance isn't as acute as it is in other areas. So in nature, there tend to be 100 girls born for every 106 boys. Naturally, there are more men born than girls. And in Beijing and major cities, you'd see that that number would be about 100 girls for 115 boys. So that's a sign of sex-selective abortions and female infanticides. But it's not wildly out of proportion. That wouldn't explain a surplus of 30 million men. But if you go to other parts of China, what becomes quickly apparent is that that gender ratio changes. It goes from 100 girls to 120 boys. 130 boys, 140 boys, 150 boys, 160 boys, and as high as 170 boys. So there are areas in China where tradition and where mere practicality, right? We have a farm and we need boys to work this, dictated that baby girls just simply weren't born. And any ones that were born as they grew up, because they were daughters, could leave, right? They could go work somewhere else. They could be a hostess, a masseuse. They could work in a factory, do something else. Whereas sons, as sons, were required to stay on family farms. And so what you have now in China are bachelor villages with up to 300 men and not a single woman under 50. So these men are also left over in the sense that mathematically it's essentially impossible for them to find a mate, which of course has stoked an industry for bride buying from places like Thailand, Vietnam, Cambodia. And these men are also competing, it's worth mentioning, with men from South Korea. South Korea had a very serious gender imbalance. It was actually worse than China's in the 90s. It's since been corrected rather miraculously, but men born in the 90s are in oversupply in Korea, so they are competing with men from China. You can add that to men from India as well. There is a crisis, right? And these men are known, not known as leftovers, they're known as guanggun, or bare branches, in reference to the fact that it's very unlikely that they will ever produce offshoots of their own. So I figured out where these surplus men were. And it became very clear that from a geographic perspective, from an economic perspective, from an educational perspective, they weren't ever even going to cross paths with these women who lived in a completely different universe. They lived in another China, right? Because we all know China is two Chinas. It's a developed country and it's a developing country. There are a lot of tremendously wealthy people and a lot of still very poor people. And you can sort of look at China's populations of so-called leftovers or people who are having a hard time getting married. You can divide them as such. But leftover women, if you really think about it, they're actually in a much more favorable situation, right? The worst thing that they're going to have to encounter is that they've grown up at a very transitional time for China, right? A lot of these women were only daughters. They're the other side of that rural coin. So they were born into families where when they found out they were having a daughter, usually after the daughter was born, because it was illegal to find out beforehand, as it still is today, they would say, okay, it's a girl. We will keep a girl. She doesn't have a brother, so we'll raise her as if she were our son. We will, you know, if we have a family business, she'll inherit the family business. If we have property, she will inherit the property. We will pour whatever money we have earned, and families in urban areas have earned a lot over the past 30 years, given the economic growth, we will pour that into her education. And so what you see in urban areas where families were brave enough to have a girl at a time when everybody else wanted a son is the rise of a sort of superclass of women, right, who have been given unprecedented access to education and professional opportunities as a result of this very grim but somewhat perfect storm that led to the very unique circumstances of their birth. And I happen to work with a lot of these women. And this wasn't a book. This was me curious to try to explain the situation that they were in. But it began pretty much as an exchange, right? They were curious to know what it was like outside of China. Is New York really like Sex and the City? No, it's not. I'm a journalist. I have some nice shoes, but that's the only parallel with Carrie Bradshaw that you'll see, right? They were curious. So it was an exchange. It just became lots of stories, lots of anecdotes. And what I noticed was that these women weren't really discussing these issues amongst themselves. I don't know if it was taboo or just considered, you know, in China, you don't really air your dirty laundry. But they were doing it with me because I was an outsider and because it was also an exchange. And so before I knew it, I kind of became the leftover whisperer where, you know, one leftover would tell another one, like, hey, go talk to her. You know, it's kind of cathartic and she'll tell you things to help. And it just, I kept accumulating all of these stories. And what struck me was that, contrary to what their very unsavory label implies, these women were very funny. They were very courageous. And they were facing their situation with a tremendous amount of grace and resolve. So yes, there were those days after Chinese New Year where they were still kind of licking their wounds. But, you know, as Shanshan said, I was like, so are you going to be like gloomy, like this forever? And she was like, oh no, just give it a week. Like, we'll bounce back. We're just kind of recovering, right? But we're far away from our families. And at the time, WeChat didn't exist. So, you know, parents couldn't constantly pester their kids. Like, did you get married yet? No, mom, I told you yesterday that I wasn't married yet. I haven't, you know, in the last 24 hours. That didn't exist. But they said, you know, we will bounce back. And that kind of, you know, gave me some hope. But I started to collect these stories. And I would also start to talk with the mothers of these women, because they would say, yeah, you really need to talk to my mom about this, or I'm getting set up on a blind date and I don't want to go. How about if I go with you? Oh yeah, okay. So, you know, I would attend blind dates, which are really funny in China. It's usually so a matchmaker, two moms, and the couple that is supposed to be set up, and then sometimes me just kind of sitting and listening in. And it's usually, you know, the couple on the date is usually sidelined on their own date because the mothers are just kind of yapping and trying to figure out if it's mengdanghudui, right? If it's matching doors and matching windows, which has been the guiding principle for marriage in China for a really long time, which is another interesting component of all of this, right? As China has become exponentially more wealthy, you see that marriage for some people has become an express elevator to a better life, right? We're talking about a communist country where there wasn't even a real estate market, right? Everybody pretty much had the same amount of wealth. Some people had more guanxi, some people had more political connections or political clout, but we're talking about a country where people more or less had the same thing. And then all of a sudden, economic reforms come in, a real estate market becomes privatized, and there's a lot going on. Right. And if you're from a modest family as a woman, probably the best way to change your situation is to get married. And you see a lot of that. But you also see the other side. Right. You see women who themselves want to be able to make that change, which led me to make the very deliberate choice to make one of the main characters in the book a mistress. Her name is Ivy. Her English name is Ivy because her legs are so long. They are like veritable tresses upon which that leafy plant could grow. And she essentially turned my concept of gender dynamics in China on their head. Right. I came into China being surprised, pleasantly surprised, that many of my female colleagues were calling the shots. And in the world of mistressing, I was also kind of one that I was not familiar with. I was also very surprised to see that that was true as well. So I thought it was necessary to include a mistress, or I wanted to, because extramarital activity is so common in China that it's also part of the reason that a lot of women are hesitant to get married, right? There are women who I worked with and women who I interviewed. I did eventually expand my pool of sources beyond my comrades at the station. I interviewed over 100 women for this book, only about 4 of them were my former colleagues, and just trying to understand, you know, their reasons for not getting married when they were supposed to. And one of them was a matter of supply. So in China, I mentioned before, there's mengdanghudui, right? You need matching doors and matching windows. But there's also been the very dogged persistence of what is known as marriage hypergamy, or in simple terms, the idea that a woman must marry up and a man must marry down, right? And that's been very easy to do in China traditionally. You marry someone taller, wealthier, with higher degree, and that's just how things are supposed to happen, right? But ever since 2011, we're starting to see in China, well, we have seen in China, that there are now more women getting college degrees than men. So for a woman to be able to marry up as she is supposed to has become less and less possible because the supply of men that she can choose from is now limited, which is going to force China to sort of rethink the rather transactional mercenary way in which marriages have been contracted for a very, very long time. So that's one of the reasons these women are having difficulty. And another one is they know how common extramarital activity is, especially once a man reaches a certain status, right? It's almost expected. I interview a very charming Lothario, and he is kind of the voice of what mistress culture is like. And he explains, yeah, I mean, for a man of my stature, it's embarrassing to not have a mistress. It's expected that I have one. And so, you know, Ivy is in there to sort of show that perspective. And the response to her has been really funny. A lot of Chinese women have said, can I meet her? She's such a seductress. I want to learn from her. Right? They've been like asking me to, you know, set up meetings with her. And then men find her very polarizing. Most men just don't like her. They're like, that Ivy is, I couldn't stand her. I mean, I was not happy with that character. But she's a very good sort of foil to another character, June, who is a Yale graduate. So she grew up in Beijing. Her father's an academic. Her mom is also in academia. And she went to Yale. Well, she went to high school in the United States and then went to Yale and came back to China at the age of 25. She gave up a really good job offer in the United States because she thought she needed to get married. So she went back to China thinking that that would be, thinking that that would be a very good idea. And not having much dating experience and being very book smart, she signed herself up for Fei Chang Wu Rao. I don't know if many of you are familiar with the show, but it was the hottest television show in China. There were like 700 million people tuning into the show. It was a dating show. And she thought from a numerical perspective, like if I can expose myself to 700 million people, like I'm sure to find a husband in a snap. And she moving back to China at 25 by saying to herself, well, if I don't find someone decent by 30, I'll just move back to the US because I'll still be young there. And if I hit 35 and there's still nobody, I don't know where I'm going to move yet. And update, she's over 30 now. There's still nobody. She's living in Hong Kong and working herself through that population without much success. And she's now eyeing Seattle because of the tech industry. Because there's Microsoft and Amazon and all of those things. She's very calculating about how she's going to do this. But Teresa is charming. So she sounds very calculating, but it comes from innocence, right? She really just believes that if you study hard, you will be able to make things happen. And she comes from a family where, you know, she is that prodigal only daughter. Her parents gave her everything. She's extremely smart. But at the same time, you know, after she graduated college, they kind of hit the point where they said, wait a minute, she's actually not our son, she's our daughter. And there are other concerns that we need to have. And if we sort of make her too excellent, well, then who's going to want to marry her? So her father would give her wonderful dating advice. She's very charismatic and she has an infectious laugh. And her father would say, look, when you go on a date, can you just like behave like the Mona Lisa? That was his advice to her. He wanted her to behave in that way. And of course, that just doesn't work, right? So the book is intended to sort of give snapshots of the situations that these women are in. And it's important as well to look at what it means for migrant women, right? Because June is lucky in the sense, her English name is Teresa, her Chinese name is June. So that's why I'm switching between the two. I hope I'm not confusing you. It's important to sort of give that context of, she's lucky in the sense that she comes from an urban area. Her parents are slightly more open-minded. But there's, you know, another character, Zhang Mei, she's from Harbin, right? The border with Siberia. Her parents are from a much smaller place. And their timelines for her marriage are much, much tighter. And what she's given up by leaving Harbin and getting a master's in the big city and working as a Chinese teacher has been, you know, she doesn't want to give up their freedom. And actually, right before Chinese New Year, her parents had given her an ultimatum. And actually, if we have a copy of the book, we can do I can give you a taste of, thank you, of what these ultimatums sound like. Is there a volunteer who wants to play Zhang Mei? Oh, this can't be such a, yeah, come on up. I mean, you can also be her mom, but I have an alter ego as a Chinese mom. I love to be a pushy Chinese mom. I can tell you a funny story about that later. Okay, so I'll be Zhang Mei's mom, and you can be Zhang Mei. All right. Lar, that's a term of endearment in Chinese. You're on your way home now?
Yes.
Have you had dinner yet?
I'll just pick up some noodles on the way home.
Ay-ya. Isn't it lonely eating on your own?
Meh. It's fine. It's late anyway.
But if you had a boyfriend, you'd have someone to eat dinner with.
Ma, what are you getting at?
Nothing. I would just feel better if you had someone to look after you. Silence. What will you do this weekend?
Relax. Do a bit of shopping, reading, see a few movies online.
Why don't you go out for a walk? See, if you had a boyfriend, there would be someone to accompany you on walks. It would be good for your health, and you wouldn't have to spend your own money.
Ma, what are you trying to say?
Why are you off work anyway? If you don't work, how will you earn money?
Ma, do you want me to work 7 days a week? If I do that, how will I even have time to spend the money I earn?
Well, if you don't have a boyfriend, you have nothing interesting to do during your free time, so you might as well work to save money. Sensing a conflict, Zhang Mei changes the subject.
Are Dad's allergies getting any better?
They're better. No need to worry about him. We're more concerned about you. We'd like you to bring a boyfriend back for Chinese New Year.
Ma, Chinese New Year is in 2 months. Where am I supposed to find someone that quickly?
We don't care where you find him. Just bring someone home.
Ma, you realize that if I bring home a random person and we get married, our relationship is unlikely to last for very long.
Not necessarily.
Okay, but there is definitely a greater chance of divorce if I marry a stranger. You'd rather increase my chances of getting a divorce?
At least you will have been married. Thank you. So that's, thank you. That's Orianne, everyone. That's, you know, Chinese moms 101. Like, this is the stuff that that young women have to put up with. And it was a lot of fun for me to observe. It was very colorful. I actually went to an episode of Fei Chang Wu Rao, so this famous dating show that June was on. Not while she was on it, but I went as an audience member, and I went with a friend of mine and her mom. And every man that came out, her mom would say, 怎么样? Like, how's this one? And her daughter would go, 质量不好, not good quality. And then the mom would look at me and she'd go, 怎么样? And I go, 质量不好. And that was just how it was. I mean, you know, moms were always there. But at the same time, at times I felt like I needed to sort of side with the daughters, right? It was kind of like their moms were trying to farm them out and that wasn't really necessary. But there were times where I thought, you know, the moms kind of aren't crazy. There were moms who would set their daughters up on like an endless array of blind dates, right? There would be, you know, several a month. And over Chinese New Year, it was like a rotating schedule. And they would say, no, that one's a male PhD. And they're all just, they have like social problems. I don't want to date those. It's like, come on, you know, you have to be open-minded. You have to work both ways. I mean, I respect that these women obviously want to date on their own, because in some cases, mothers meddle to the point where they'll set up dating profiles for their daughters. This is a thing in China. So Shiji Jiayuan, it's the largest online dating profile in China. And there are many moms and who set up dating profiles for their kids on it. And they'll, you know, chat up prospective men in ways that young women never would, right? So I have transcripts of that in China in the book of like a friend's mom saying to a man, I want to be your right arm and your left shoulder and I want to, you know, make a life. And it's like, you know, they're just chatting on their platform. And then this actually happened in the case of a man. I have one of the characters in the book, Guang, is a very eligible bachelor. So he's what is known as a Gaofu Shuai. So he's tall, he's wealthy, and he's handsome. He owns like 17 apartments in Beijing, which is, it makes you, you know, irresistible, apparently. And he was a platinum member on Shiji Jiayuan. He's so eligible that he didn't have to pay membership, and people were making a big fuss at the fact that he was on there. And he said, I was having a great time until my dad decided that I needed to get married, and he edited my platform, and he put an end to my hookups. And that was the end, right? So, you know, Chinese parents are involved in a way that surprised me. Obviously, coming from the United States, I really couldn't imagine my mom at a park with a piece of cardboard and my attributes, you know, trying to, this happens, right? This is a very common thing. I spent time in those parks. I actually set up a few friends on dates as a result of meetings with mothers that I'd had in those parks. But it's, you know, it's just kind of a taste of how things operate there. But at the same time, it's important to consider that the parents are doing this out of love, right? It may sound meddlesome and it may sound like they're getting in the way and that it isn't their business, but I had to think long and hard about where they'd come from. A lot of them had grown up during the Cultural Revolution, right? So they didn't have choices. When they showed up at the Damwei or the work unit where they were, you know, going to work, there wasn't housing for unmarried people. So many times, you know, the head of the work unit would say, you together. And that was it. That's how some of the parents of these women had, you know, had their marriages set up. So the idea of them falling in love or finding a soulmate just seems so impractical and also dangerous. I go back in the book and I look at sort of the history of romantic love in China. I look at the etymology of ai, the word for love, ai qing, right? Which really just meant sentiment. In Qing Dynasty literature and at the beginning of the 1900s, it meant something completely different. And it was also shocking to me that Chinese people don't usually say wo ai ni. They don't say I love you to one another. This is a culture where it's sort of been somewhat taboo. And it's not, ooh, someone just gave someone a look like, this is very telling in Chinese culture, right? So if you go back into Qing Dynasty literature, you'll see that there was a lot of extramarital activity. So people fell in love. They had electrifying relationships, but they weren't allowed to marry those people. And you would always see very clearly that in the literature, the person that they were in love with, the woman they were in love with, would usually turn out to be an evil fox spirit. Right, so you had a wonderful time, but it's like, watch out. We did not pre-approve this woman. She doesn't come from our circles. Her family's plot of land is not next to our family's plot of land, and so she is a fox spirit. And so you must be careful, right? This is kind of the vibe that romantic love has had for a long time in China. And so for the first time, what I almost saw in these leftover women was kind of crusaders for romantic love. They weren't interested in the houses, the chizi, fangzi, piaozi, the car, the house, the cash, which are considered the three prerequisites for any man in China to be considered marriageable, which has had, by the way, crazy side effects on the property market, right? This is a bit of an aside, but, you know, China's property market has been a big motor of its economic growth. Part of that is because parents invested heavily in property in order to make their kids more marriageable, right? There's a shortage of women. So how do you position your son as being more favorable in the marriage market? You buy the biggest possible house that you can find, so the matchmaker pays you attention. And this happened in rural areas to the extent that Chinese families were so desperate to set their sons up with a potential mate that they would put a phantom third story on their home. So they'd build a two-story house, and they wouldn't be able to afford the third story, but they'd build like a facade to make it look more imposing from the outside. And when that wasn't really cutting it, they would put lightning rods on top of that third to make it look even taller. And the researcher who's the expert on this said he arrived in a village and he was very confused because he didn't think that the Chinese were religious. He thought that the lightning rods were crosses. He was very confused about what was going on.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Listen to thousands of our podcasts on iTunes or Google Play. And when you're in the Bay Area, please join us live for one of our 450 programs each year. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now, back to our program.
So it has had very dizzying side effects on the marriage market, on the property market. And that sort of mercenary idea of meng dang hu due and your plot of land is next to my plot of land still sort of reigns supreme in the minds of parents, right? They think, we've invested a lot in our child. We've given you, as our only child in most cases, everything we have. And we expect that that be reciprocated because there's no social security in China. Very few companies offer pension funds. So you have to think that parents are kind of looking at their kids going, you're our retirement fund. You're our nest egg. You're marrying well is directly correlated to our comfort in our older years. And so they're involved. And because, by and large, they hold most of the cash, right? They're the ones who can afford to make those property purchases, not their sons. Men in their 20s can't afford to buy property in any city in China. They also have some veto power, right? If they say, oh, you want to marry her, we don't agree. And without our money to buy this house, you won't be able to marry anyone anyway. Parents are still very involved in that process, which, you know, is interesting to look at in the context of China, which is now starting to see the rise of an individual, right? We're just starting to see the first generations who can choose a partner. And actually, most importantly, for whom marriage is discretionary. Up until 1990, less than 2% of the Chinese population remained unmarried. And we're seeing those numbers climb at unprecedented rates. A lot of that is this mismatch in the market that I was talking about earlier. Right, you have more and more educated women who are expected to marry up and can't do so. That's going to change. It's changed in every country in the world. Women out-educate men in most parts of the world. They get more college degrees than men in most parts of the world, and they figured it out. They're marrying sideways, diagonally, upside down, backwards. It's that system of hypergamy has eroded, but it has remained very persistent in China. And part of that are these, you know, parents who have these ideals that they stick to, and a culture essentially that has not evolved as quickly as China and as the country itself. It's a transition period, and it was fascinating to examine, and its implications don't seem like they'll be going away anytime soon. So something that doesn't get discussed very often is this idea that the actual worst year for the one-child policy, so the year during which there were the most sex-selective abortions, was actually 2005. That was just 3 years before the Beijing Olympics. Beijing already had the bid. I'm actually kind of in shock that the Olympic Committee didn't see this as a barrier to hosting the Olympics in China, which essentially means that boys in China who are 13 years old are going to have a harder time than any other generation in China finding a wife. One, because their generation is the most imbalanced, but because there's essentially a blockage of 30 years, right, of men, you know, not finding someone in their own age cohort and having to go back another age cohort. This has been happening for years, right? So there's a buildup of men who are going to be looking for a partner. And, you know, down the line, it's going to be something that China has to consider. One last piece, and then I'm happy to open it up to questions, is the two-child policy. Right. So obviously the one-child policy was an important part of what I researched because it was kind of the catalyst for a lot of the changes that happened to this group of women that I observed. China now has a two-child policy as of 2016. That was not instituted to give women greater reproductive freedoms. A lot of the greater freedoms that women have in China are not usually by design. It's usually because of some ulterior motive. And this was true. So China's population is shrinking as a result of the one-child policy, as a result of urbanization, as a result of a lot of different factors. And they realized that in order to remain competitive, because essentially everything that China has achieved has been, you know, as a result of its power in numbers, you send hundreds of millions of people from rural areas to work in factories and you can grow a nation, right? This population is shrinking and the government is concerned about it. So there's now a two-child policy. We've seen, based on the births that have happened since 2016, the government was predicting 21 million births a year. It's been almost half that number. So they were absolutely off. I think they finally understood that fertility is not a switch. And if you just tell women you can have two children, it doesn't mean that magically every woman is going to serve up a second child for you. But we also have seen that the vast majority of women who have had children in China during this time are at the end of their fertility scale. So China has seen a record number of birth complications this year and last year as a result of the switch. So what we'll see going forward will be probably a China that abolishes the two-child policy and thinks a little bit harder about how they're going to incentivize childbearing. And towards the end of the book, I think it's important to draw parallels with other countries in East Asia because they've gone through similar transitions, right? Japan is an economy that took off before China's. So did South Korea. So did Singapore. As those economies took off, women got more access to education and they started working in higher rates and marriage rates and birth rates started going down. This is nothing new, right? These are trends that we've seen since the 60s. And you can very easily look at China and say, China's going to go along the same path. And part of that would mean that marriage rates go down, birth rates go down. We're already seeing that. But that the economy is also going to stagnate, right? China's economy has been growing at least 7 to 8% for the past couple of years, which is something that not a lot of countries can do. The divorce rate has actually been growing at the same rate, by the way, which is an interesting comparison. Japan's and South Korea's have been stagnating around 2% for a very long time. Why is that? I think a large part of that has to do with the female workforce participation. Japan and South Korea, to an extent, are cautionary tales for China. If you don't involve women in the formal economy, like China has very successfully done, it is home to the largest population of self-made female billionaires in the world, and the way that China has managed to bring people out of poverty, educate them, get them literate, and into the workforce is really unprecedented. You get in trouble when they're not involved. In Japan, it's still not uncommon for women to pursue a clerical career track. And the idea is you go to college, you're educated, but you essentially become a secretary. And the idea is that you'll marry someone at your firm and then check out for 13 years while you raise your child, because it's still largely considered taboo to outsource childcare in Japan. That, of course, doesn't help the economy when half of your workforce is out of it for 13 years. South Korea is not quite as bad, but it's still very difficult to juggle both of those things, and a lot of that also comes from this idea of hagwon, the extracurricular activities that Korean kids have to do. It's impossible to not have one parent dedicated full time to all of the outside studies that a child has to do. China doesn't have that problem. A lot of people in their 60s and 70s can't wait to have a grandchild, mainly because they were denied of the pleasure of raising their own child, right? They grew up at a time where they had to work. And after having a child, they probably had to hand it over to their own grandparents. One of the women in the book is from Shanghai, and her parents, sent her to the United States to be educated. They bought her an apartment in New York. They bought her a car in New York. And they're telling her, you need two children. Everyone in China can have two children now. We want you to have a second, because the second one needs to be our designated grandchild. It needs to take our last name, because we're bringing a lot. We've given you a lot of opportunities, and we know that one grandchild is going to belong to your husband's family, because that's just how it works. But the second one is our heir, because they're valuing their daughters in that regard, and they're expecting to have a fair share of that familial relationship. So overall, I would say China is probably going to avoid the path that other East Asian economies have taken, because its women are going to be an important force of its economy going forward, and also its demography. And with that rather optimistic note of these women shaping the world next superpower, because I really do believe they will, I'm happy, I'm just on time, happy to open it up to questions if there are any.
I was just wondering, these women that are in the cities now that have gotten good jobs and they don't want to move down, are they moving into professional jobs like the Communist Party hierarchy or in business? And are they going to be forces to be reckoned with in the future compared to the men who traditionally held those roles?
Sure. Good question. So not a lot of them are making their way into the party. And I'm not sure if that's because it's not that desirable or if they're just simply not interested in politics. But it's important to note that China is essentially run by a sea of men with black hair and black suits. And it's one of the most puzzling things. The Economist recently celebrated its 175th anniversary, and our editor, Zanny Mitten-Meadows, was in town for the occasion. She went to the China Development Forum and was blown away by all of the plans that China has between the Belt and Road Initiative and everything else. And she said, I just can't reconcile the fact that all of the people there were men, but that consistently the most impressive executives that I meet in China are women. And so the way I try to explain that is that the women are present in the private sector. That's where they're making headwaves. If you look, even in the Valley, I'm always consistently impressed by the percentage of Chinese women in the VC space. You just don't see American women involved in investments and startups. You don't see it at the same rate. And I've asked Chinese women, why? Why are there so many more of you than American women in the space? And part of that could be, okay, the internet took off after the whole e-commerce and everything took off in China after it did in the US. So maybe there was more time for women to enter it. But a simple answer that I often get is Chinese women aren't afraid to make money. We don't get you American women, who are roundabout in your approach to things. Like, we go for it. I guess a part of it is sort of the culture that they grew up in, right? In China, this is sort of what you do. And the communist, the Cultural Revolution did help in that regard, because it kind of made everyone sexless and work shoulder to shoulder. And some remnants of that still do play out today. So I think we'll see them being an important force in the private sector, especially because one of the main things China needs to do now to maintain its economic growth is stimulate domestic consumption. Right? It no longer works to dole out large state loans. Because as we've seen since the 90s when those started, a lot of those loans ended up in feckless projects that aren't paying off. Right? So there's debt that a lot of large state-owned enterprises just can't pay back. So how do you compensate for that? You try to stimulate domestic consumption. China has, you know, been the factory of the world for a very long time and is now very seriously trying to transition to a different economy. I actually wanted to call this book Made in China, M-A-I-D-E-N. I had a big fight with my publisher about it because I really wanted to call it that. I think these women, in addition to being maidens, right, represent China's maiden journey from being the manufacturing capital of the world to a different kind of economy, a more knowledge and service-based economy. And when you think about who's best poised to help the government make that transition, it's this talent pool of women that you already have sitting in urban areas with, you know, who could be wonderful employees for this. And so I think they will really shine in that sector. And of course, as consumers, well, I think there are very few of you that don't understand the buying power of Chinese women. I saw statistics that came out the other day from Alibaba, and I think it was like the average Chinese woman buys 15 lipsticks a year, and I don't know how many handbags, and she's like, they're there, right? They're a part. And they're not cheap lipsticks either, right? So they're an important part of that domestic economy, and I think the Chinese government is practical enough. They want to maintain growth at all costs, right? The GDP is a matter of pride for China. And if they understand, which I think they do, that women are an important part of that going forward, they probably won't do much to jeopardize it. So,
don't they need to get more women in government?
They do. And that's something that I don't see happening anytime soon. But getting back to mistress culture, I think behind a lot of the men in power, you do have women who aren't in the spotlight, but are involved in some of those decisions, and maybe more on local levels. It really is kind of a gray area. It's not an area that I think many women want to get into. I mean, at least of the women I know and of the sample, like working for the Communist Party is something their parents encourage them to do. They want them to take the test. They want them to get into the system because it's considered stable, right? It's a tiawan fan. It's an iron rice bowl. You're guaranteed job security and a relative, you know, a reasonable amount of wealth for life. But it's just not appealing. They're educated, they've been exposed to other cultures, and they want to work in the private sector where they feel like they can, you know, reach a different sort of potential.
Roseanne?
Yes. Hi.
Hi. I wanted to give credit to the highest visible woman in Chinese government and some historical perspective about how she got there. And then the fact that, as you say, the private sector is an alternative to state employment. Her name is Fu Ying, F-U-Y-I-N-G, and she has the silver hair. And so she does travel to international conferences and speak on stage, but she is a minority still.
Yeah.
When you look at the state council and all the levels of government. But the fact that she can even be there, I learned when the Chinese Revolution in the second year, 1949, the fall of 1950, they admitted girls at a 50-50 ratio into university in the days when you could come from rural areas and villages. It was all free, and the government was just educating as many of the young generation as they could. So when we got to China as an AT&T, a business family in the late 80s, the compliment to that would be that the women that my husband worked with in the Ministry of Post and Telecommunications, the one in Shanghai was a woman. She was the top dog in the ministry at that point because so many of the childcare services that were available and that the women had assigned Danhui, just like the men, whoever got home first buys groceries and cooks. So it was either the husband or the wife, depending on where they worked, where they lived, who could get to the market, and you get home, and you start the cooking.
Now you just order it online and it's there when you get there.
I know. things have changed.
Yeah.
But I just wanted to throw those perspectives in because there are government policies that have made a difference as well.
There are, and a lot of them have come from the All China Women's Federation, which the 50s has been a very powerful organization. It's just one that seems to have impacted the lives of women in more rural areas more than urban areas, right? It has more clout in those areas. And to your point about admitting women at a 50-50 rate, they did do that in the past. They're not doing it anymore. So starting in 2012, there were universities in China that were spooked by the high test scores that girls were getting, and everything from primary school exams all the way up to the Gaokao, which is China's equivalent of the SAT, but a lot more severe. And so a lot of universities in China, when you apply to school, there's not recommendations and extracurriculars and a portfolio of things that your application is based on. It's just a number. It's your test score. And there were universities starting in 2012, big, well-respected universities that started making the admission scores for girls in certain fields, in 提前批次, so early admission type fields, they were making them higher. So if you wanted to, I don't know, study journalism and you were a male, you needed to score 700. And if you were a girl, you needed to score 750. And I spoke to, obviously this is blatant discrimination, right? And I spoke to admissions officers at places like Tsinghua, off the record, of course, asking, how can you permit this? Do you think this is okay? And their response was, look, we don't think it's okay, but we have to do it. In order to ensure the legacy of our universities, men are overwhelmingly more likely to make big discoveries and become famous. And we need to have these names coming from our university. So we need to protect the men. Like in the country where you aborted 30 million baby girls, you need to protect the men all of a sudden. Like they were calling it a boy crisis. Like what can we do? The Gaokao is fixed. You know, it's created to make it easier for men to get. So that has changed. I mean, some of the values of the Cultural Revolution have eroded over time. But even so, women have seemed to be doing okay, and they're still doing remarkably well on standardized exams and everything else. And people, some feminist activists I know did take that to the Ministry of Education, and a lot of universities were forced to, you know, equalize their scores. But it did go on for at least 5 or 6 years. So it's a different reality today. Yes.
I was thinking of all the migrant workers who've flooded Shenzhen and all the factories. What about those women who are from the countryside and have a hard time finding a mate? I would expect, I mean, working 6 days a week. Could you address that issue?
Yeah. So for the women in rural areas, I spent less time there, right? The focus really was on women in urban areas. But compared to men in rural areas, they have a much easier time because they have more mobility. Yes, they do work very long hours, which makes it complicated. But they're still able to marry up relatively easily, right? If they're maybe leaving a factory, working somewhere, it also depends what field they're working in. There's a great book called Red Lights by a Harvard scholar who goes undercover at a karaoke bar in Chongqing, I think it is. It's a fascinating book. And she talks about, you know, how women from rural areas are working as hostesses in these karaoke parlors. And a lot of times they'll become the mistress of one of their clients or end up, you know, eventually marrying one of their clients, and how they're supporting entire families in rural areas because they make a lot more money than men can make, right? If a man is working in a factory and a woman is in, you know, as a hostess or something, she can make a lot more money. They're buying, you know, medicines for relatives or other siblings in the case of, you know, multiple child family. And actually, this was true to the extent that when there was a crackdown on prostitution and on these, you know, KTV parlors, the taxis suffered. There was, you know, no money left in the banks because all the women had taken it out. They're an important backbone of that economy. But they do have a lot more class mobility, given that they are women and they can marry out of that situation or work their way out of it, than the men who are really, you know, just in oversupply and stuck in ways that the women just aren't.
Rural women who come into city factories save the money and go back and start small businesses?
That does happen. Yeah, I mean, you have a lot of very entrepreneurial Chinese women who do that. Yeah, it's not uncommon. You do, working in a factory isn't a lifelong thing. You do it for, you know, a short period of time to earn a certain amount of wealth and then move into something else or stay in a big city and escalate to another job. Part of the reason that wages have gone up in factories in China is, one, the price of raw materials has gone up, but also because with all these chat platforms, people can communicate with one another and say, hey, I'm now working at this other factory. The salary and the work conditions are much better. Why don't you come here? And that has forced factories overall to raise their work standards, which means that a lot of this manufacturing is now moving to places like Vietnam and Thailand, where, you know, people are willing to endure not so favorable working conditions, because in China, that just, the wages are too high. It doesn't cut it anymore. And when you combine that with China's desire to, I mean, you know, China's in a pretty powerful, it's in a powerful position right now. And part of that sort of clout that it has in, you know, in the world stage would be reinforced by making more advances in life sciences, in any sort of technology, which is really where they're focusing all of their energy. So I think the rural, the people working in factories, that will probably be represent a smaller and smaller part of the population going forward anyway.
Ask if, would you say that most of the women you interviewed are happy with their lives?
Happy with their lives.
Yeah.
Well,
were it not for their parents with this pressure, are they satisfied?
I mean, I haven't met a single one who seems to be, it's a really a gruesome word. And I think I've been desensitized to it because I've been working on this topic for such a long time. But to give you a sense of sort of what it's becoming, I was doing a book talk in Beijing and a young woman came up to me at the end and she said, I wanted to talk to you and would you sign my book? My teacher just went to go buy it for me. And I was like, your teacher, you're with your teacher. How old are you? And she said, I'm 16. I'm going to be a leftover. And I was like, wow, you're starting early these days, you know, 16. Is really early. And I said, what makes you say that? And she said, I just know that the things that I want to accomplish are not going to be done by the time I'm 25. And so I'm going to disappoint my parents, but I'm going to be okay, right? And I think a lot of women see it that way. This is not a label that they're going to have forever. It's just a different timeline. They're not going to get married by 25, some of them will, because they have a greater portfolio of things that they want to do and things that they want to accomplish, and probably different types of men that they want to date, right? Traditionally in China, you date someone to marry. You don't date for the sake of learning how to date. And it was actually fascinating. I went back and I started to draw some parallels between like when dating culture started to become a thing in the United States. And it turns out that the invention of the car or the common use of the car was a big part of it, right? Because prior to that, if a guy wanted to date a girl, he usually had to do it on her patio in full view of her parents and everyone else, right? But as soon as the car is common, you can get her out. You can take her to the movies. You can take her to like a soda pop shop. And that's when a dating culture becomes, there's more traction, right? And things happen. And I tried to find parallels with the rise of the bicycle in China, but something about that handlebar teetering movement just like isn't quite the same. And you're just starting to see that now. And a lot of people like June, that main character, they just don't know how to. It's not something that they have cultural references for. And, you know, there's a lot of self-help books for people to try to figure it out. And parents don't help in that regard because they're very marriage-minded, right? So you're seeing a lot of that emerge now. And I think the exploration process is fun. And it also helps that these people have exposure to different places. So no, I wouldn't say they were. And anyone who has seen the Leftover monologues will do that, right? So the reason I did that stage play, the Leftover monologues, was because I had heard so many funny, moving stories that I did my best to capture them in a book with as much color as I possibly could, but I knew I would never do them justice like the people who told me them themselves. And so I wanted to give a live audience the experience of hearing and just experiencing what I had when I was interviewing these people. And the stories were funny. I mean, you know, foreigners would come and they'd go, we had no idea that these women could be so funny, because they would talk about, you know, silly blind dates, you know, ridiculous things that happen, and also ridiculous standards that their moms would hold them to. So, I don't know, one girl, for example, was a female PhD, and she started off her monologue by saying, I'm not a man, I'm not a woman, I'm a female PhD. Essentially, she's part of another gender in China altogether, which essentially means that men don't want to get anywhere near her, right? Because, whoa, she is way too educated for anyone to possibly be interested. And so the play was very uplifting and it was very funny. And I think it surprised a lot of people in that regard. And I was personally surprised that we managed to pull it off 5 weekends in a row. The last crowd, over 500 people showed up. It was by far one of the coolest things I ever got to do. And we were not shut down by the Chinese government, which I was almost slightly insulted by. I was like, really? You don't think what I'm doing here, like amassing such a crowd to talk about this topic, you're not going to bother me about it? But we did not. A lot of people thought we were going to get shut down, but we did not. And so just hearing those stories was really important. And when this book launched in February in New York, we brought back the monologue. So I invited three Chinese women who were studying in the U.S., in New York and Philly, to give monologues. And they were talking about their own personal monologues, right? So every woman in the play told her own story. These were not actresses. And we also invited men to be a part of it. So we had leftover men telling their stories as well. And it really helped the audience get some context for this, that this is not a tragic thing. This is actually quite a triumphant thing. I mean, I wrote this book to celebrate the women in it. And, you know, there have been some reviews where people say, oh, but the plight of the women. No, it's not a plight. The point is, I mean, yes, the cards are stacked against them and it's an unpleasant situation to be in, but they're approaching it with the right attitude. They're not feeling bad for themselves. Ultimately, to be in the position to be left over, to have the option when to get married, to who to marry, and, you know, if you're going to get married or not, that's actually a basic human right when you think about it that many women in the world just don't have. And if they did, imagine what our economies would look like, right? If women didn't have to get married at 14 and have 4 children by the age of 20, imagine how they could get educated and the different jobs that they could have and the money that they could save and the futures that they could provide for their children. There's a lot there. Right? So China has just transitioned to a time where women have these opportunities, and it's a good thing. Yeah. Well, there's a mic coming. This will be our last
question. Okay, this is the last question. I just wanted to point out that I was 100% made in China. So your book name, Made in China.
All right. And I knew we should have chosen that.
I used to be a leftover in China as well.
See, so we get rid of this situation. It's not permanent.
So your story, the stories you were telling tonight was just really fascinating, and it's very familiar to me. And I heard a lot before from different, you know, friends and colleagues and whatsoever. So I have a question for you. It sounds like you've been speaking to more than 100 women, leftover women, and you have a lot of conversations and funny stories. I'm just curious about, have you ever, when you were talking to them, have you ever given them advices? And if you did, on how they resonate the advices and what are basically the
outcomes? I thought you were going to say, did you talk to any men? And I was going to say, yes, of course I did. And I was going to tell you about that. But advice, yes. I've been asked for advice. And I'm like, oh, good Lord. I should charge for this. But no, not really. So I'm often asked at book events and even just prior, like, how do I get my parents to leave me alone? Right? How do I get them off my back? And so I've thought about this, having this alter ego of a Chinese mom myself. I've thought about this. And my advice is, you know, your parents have more disposable income than they've ever had. WeChat is a beast, right? Everybody's on WeChat. There's this wonderful thing called Moments, which is kind of a cross between Instagram and Facebook and WhatsApp. And everybody wants likes on Moments. And your parents are traveling more, right? They're going to Egypt. They're going to the Vatican. They're going to all these wild places because they're retired and they finally have the money to do so. Distract them. Encourage them to travel. Let them get hobbies, right? Don't have them sitting in parks playing mahjong and asking about, you know, when your ovaries are going to expire. Get them out of the country. Instead of going home for Chinese New Year, treat them on a vacation. Take them somewhere else. You know, renovate their home. Do something else to distract them. And it actually works. So one woman I know said, you know, my mom isn't bothering me about finding a husband anymore. And this is shocking because I just split up with the guy I was supposed to marry. And she was really bent out of shape with it. But I finally figured out why. She has become a bit of a star on this Chinese karaoke app. So you can sing into this app and fans can vote on you and give you likes and give you like small amounts of change. And her mom has become really popular. So she wakes up every morning and she sings, much to the dismay of her husband, who's just like, oh my God, can we leave this, you know, app alone? But she's become a star and she's very involved in her budding career and has left her daughter alone. So I think the key really is that, like, let them enjoy themselves more fully. They have opportunities to travel and do things and spend money in ways that, you know, no other generations of Chinese in their 60s and 70s have been able to. So let them enjoy that and let them also see that you're fine. I'm certain that all of the moms that I've met know that their daughters are going to be just fine, but they just have moments where they panic. And that's usually when they're playing mahjong or they're out in the park where another woman says to her, you know, oh, when's the daughter getting married? And she's like, oh, I don't know. Let me ask the daughter. And the pressure gets transferred. But that's only in those situations, right? Most of the time, they're okay. One woman actually said, Zhang Mei, who's from Harbin, said, you know, I finally figured something out. Harbin is very cold. It's on the border with Siberia. And heat in China usually comes on when the state decides it's going to come on. So in Beijing, it usually came on November 15th, and we all froze until November 15th. In Harbin, it comes on in early October because it's colder. And she says, you know, there's always this period of time where I don't hear from my mom about the marriage pressure. And I think it's because heat is coal-powered in China, right? And so when it first comes on, the air is terrible. And a lot of people don't go out to socialize. And she firmly believes that because her mom is not in the park talking to the other moms, she's not bothering her. And as soon as the air clears and then Chinese New Year's around the corner, this is when she goes into like full speed and does dialogues like the one we did earlier. But until that happens, she kind of leaves her alone. So it's really, I mean, China is a society that revolves on face, right? Mianzi. And what other people think of you and of your family is incredibly important. And so if for some reason you've got a stubborn nail that is sticking out, people are going to want to hammer it in. That's how it works for everything. And you know, after you get married, the pressure doesn't end. It's 什么时候生孩子, right? When is the child coming? And now it's like, when is the second child coming? And I know a woman in New York who just had her first child. She's Chinese. And her father said, we need you to have three children because you live in the U.S. now and anyone in China can have two. You're better than that. So like the pressure just doesn't end ever. This is just the nature of having Chinese parents, I guess.
Roseanne, thank you so much. Thank you very much for an informative and entertaining talk.
Thank you. Thanks for coming. This has been an honor. Thank you.
This is great fun. And she's going to stay and sign her book, which is very entertaining, I must say. Thank you so much. And thank you all for joining us tonight.
All right.
This meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California is now adjourned.